KFCC live on Planet FM.
Stay tuned for current affairs, conversation, interviews, music and more.
As we explore the perspectives and stories from resettled communities.
And bring you information from within the resettlement sector.
Okay, Haura, assalamu alaikum. This is Galwak Shol bringing you the Resettlement Radio, a voice of the community of the resettlement community. Thank you for tuning in. If you have just joined us, you are listening to Resettlement Radio brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6. And the artist who is singing now is Sona Jaberte from the Gambia. The Gambia is a tiny country in West Africa, and she's a vocalist, a very well-known vocalist in Africa. And so I will be taking you through 1 hour show today, and I will play you a music as well. But first of all, thanks to those people who have shown us the support, the love, and what it means to be a community in an ARCC AGM yesterday. It was a successful report, hard work done by the community leaders, hard work done by the support of the supporting group, especially our partners and our supporters and our friends. And we reflect back on the year, what we have accomplished so far, and it's a long journey as a community together. We are thankful to those who gave us the support yesterday, coming to AGM, although they have a lot of things to do and they have a very tight schedule, but they came anyway. Thank you. Thank you so much. And in that AGM, we confirmed Jessica Smith as the chairperson of the governance board of ARCC. This is a very great achievement. Jessica has been in ARCC for like two years or so, replacing Super Gunn, who has been a chair in the previous year. And Super has done a lot of amazing things in ARCC as a chairperson of the governance board, and the members of the board who have been actively engaging in the governance activities. So we give thanks to outgoing chairperson of the board, which is Super Gunn, and we love you, Sipra, and we will always be with you. And remember, you are part of our community. You did not step out of the community. You just step down from the board because of the other things you do. So you are still with us in the community, and we will always acknowledge what you do. We are a community all together. And new members of the governance board were confirmed. Thanks to the community for coming out so strongly that they appreciate the members of the community who want to serve the community in a level of governance board. And we thank those who have taken the courage to serve this community in the capacity of local of the governance board. You know, it takes one person to step up, to give a lot of work to what has been initiated in the community. And all of us, we work together. We fall together, we rise together. This is the motto we have. You know, it's not a one-man work. It's all of us. Thanks to our general manager, Aban Yor. He has put a lot of work in the AGM, and he's always the guy we turn to in ARCC whenever you are taken down by a lot of work, because Aban is always there day and night. He's so helpful. We are so lucky there to have a leader like him. Sometimes he doesn't mind whether you call him at midnight or on Sunday. He's there to help. Such a generous guy. Aban, God bless you. In that note, I would like us to focus today on the resettlement journey. On the resettlement journey is a long journey for those who have never crossed the road of refugee journey. It's not good. It's full of ups and downs. and it takes time. It takes a lot of time to get to the what you can describe as a destination. It's not always easy. So how do we go with that? We describe our journey in the form of stories, which we call the resettlement stories. And a resettlement story in the form of Beyond Refuge. And why we call it Beyond Refuge is because we have taken a lot of journey in the country of origin. And you know, when the safety has been questioned, or when your life has been in danger, whether it's a political, whether it's a civil war, whether it's a famine, whether it's a natural disaster, your life has been affected by that, and then you need to leave. Not that you need to leave, but there's no way out. You know, you have to run. You must get out. And the way out is not always easy. There is a lot of loss on the way. Some family members lost loved ones, and some do not even know where their loved ones are. Up to now, maybe 10 years, 20 years ago, not even have no contacts with their families. I know this because I've gone through this one. I had hard time to comprehend who am I, because when things like that happen, sometimes you lost in touch with the family, and I've been away from my family for quite a long time. And no contacts. I did not even know whether they were alive. They did not even know whether I was alive. So such a traumatizing movement, and you are going through difficulty in the journey. It's not easy. So that's why it's very important that I bring you stories to tell the journey of the resettlement in some of our communities who have put their stories together. These stories have taken... I have taken them from the book, Beyond Refuge, storybook, excuse me. And this is the first edition that we had in 2017. Now we will be coming out with a second edition, which will have more stories than what we have. Currently, we have 12 or 13 stories in the first edition. These are the stories that I will play some of them here. And the second edition will come out in the end of this year. Will have more stories than the previous one, probably about 20 stories, which is very amazing. And all these 20 stories are from different countries, just like the first edition. They are from Africa, they are from Asia, you know, all over, cultures, different ethnicities. It's very amazing when you hear all these journeys with the same mission, although they come from different places. You know, the mission is one. Look for the safety, and that's what it is all along. And I'm grateful that some people managed to get things together. So now, without going any further, let me play to you some of these stories, and sometime I will come in for the music, and I will play you the best music from different parts of the world. Now, I tune it in. I mean, I put it on. Congo as a French-speaking nation, so I did all of my education in French. Not many Congolese people speak English. My family is a big African family. I have my mom and dad, 4 brothers and 2 sisters. I am the youngest. My family lived in a village called Goma, the eastern region of Democratic Republic of Congo, where I was born and raised and where I spent most of my life. My life in Goma had been good until foreign forces came and took control over my country. The foreign forces used their organized militias to lynch innocent people. After the president and military dictator of Democratic Republic of Congo, at the time my country was called Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko, was overthrown in 1996, the instability in Democratic Republic of Congo became worse because of mass murders. Even ordinary families were targeted, but no one was ever held accountable for the crimes committed. At that time, my older brother worked at a human rights agency in Kinshasa, the capital city of Democratic Republic of Congo. His job mostly involved recording and reporting atrocities committed by various armed groups.
Because of my older brother's work as a human rights activist, unknown people sent us hate messages numerous times and threatened our lives. Later, they launched a massive hunt to kill my older brother, so he had to go into hiding and I accompanied him. They were so determined to kill my older brother and the rest of our family. One day, our family heard that some armed men came to our village and killed three of our family's friends for failing to locate us. The armed men took the bodies into the bush, chopped them into parts, and displayed the cut-off parts in our village. The killers did so as a way of sending a message to us that no one in our family would be spared. The unfortunate killing of our family's friends was shocking. We felt frightened. The scariest part was that we didn't even know who these armed men were. They could be anyone. They could even have been state-sponsored organized groups. We had no idea. Knowing that our family was in imminent danger, my older brother talked to the Red Cross, requesting that our family should be smuggled out through the border to Uganda. The Red Cross knew about the threat to our family, so we were all crammed into a car marked as the Red Cross and secretly driven to the Uganda border. Fortunately, we managed to escape safely. From the Ugandan border, we started to look for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda. In a United Nations High Commissioner office, we were able to register ourselves as refugees under protection. The officer asked us to stay in a refugee camp in Uganda. However, my older brother resisted the idea of our family staying at a refugee camp. He demanded that we should live in Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. This was because the refugee camp was so poorly protected and we could easily be killed. I also felt that those who wanted to exterminate us in Democratic Republic of Congo might still be pursuing us on Ugandan soil. In the end, our family was able to move to Kampala and stay there. Sadly, my older brother's wife died soon after in Kampala due to what the post-mortem report described as poisoning. I also got scared. I felt that from that moment on, any one of us could die at any time. Not long after the tragic death of my brother's wife, one of his twin sons also passed away by poisoning. It was a double tragedy for our family. Later, we found out that those killers had indeed pursued us all the way from Democratic Republic of Congo to Uganda. This made me think that the enemy might have already been at the refugee camp, mingling with us unknowingly, and that they could see us, but we could not see them. Our family felt so anxious that we had to request to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to arrange settlement to another country under a protection case. The United States, Canada, and Australia were on our top three choices. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was fully convinced that our lives were indeed in danger. In the beginning of 2002, we lodged our application for resettlement, and we waited until any country accepted our application. While waiting in the refugee camp in Kampala, my cousin and I opened a tailoring shop. The little income that we received from the tailoring business supplemented the meager assistance that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees had provided us. Canada was the first country that responded to our application. Unfortunately, it declined our request for resettlement, but they did not provide any reason. We later learned from our friends that Canada accepted only refugees with small-sized families and people who speak proper English for resettlement. Our family consisted of 15 members. It's a small village. Also, no one in our family spoke good English. We had lived in Kampala for 7 years as refugees. At that time, I was still single, but my older brother remarried. Despite the help from the rest of us, it was still hard for him to take care of all his young children. In the beginning of 2009, New Zealand responded to our case, and we heard that our application was finally successful. At the end of 2009, our family arrived in New Zealand. Life in New Zealand was different to Democratic Republic of Congo. First of all, I couldn't speak English at all, because I had never gone to any English school. All I knew in English was the word good. So when people asked me, "How are you?" I answered, "Good." When people asked me, "Where are you going?" I replied, "Good." When people asked me, "How long have you been here?" I said, "Good." Sometimes I even responded in French. In the first 6 weeks in New Zealand, we stayed at Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre. And then all 15 of us were taken from Auckland to Hamilton for resettlement. Once we arrived in Hamilton, volunteers from the Refugee and Migrant Services offered us a lot of support. For the first 6 months, they helped us with opening bank accounts, shopping, paying bills, and managing our lives in this new home, city, and country. The Congolese and Sudanese communities in Auckland also gave us a lot of support for our resettlement in Hamilton. The hardest thing as a newcomer in Hamilton was to find a job. It was very difficult to get one. Most employers asked me if I had any work experience in New Zealand. I couldn't understand why I needed work experience in New Zealand for a job that anyone was capable of. Having a prerequisite for work experiences in New Zealand would have been a great challenge for any immigrants from refugee backgrounds who had just arrived. Initially, I came to New Zealand with a mindset that I would not depend on social welfare. I was determined to start working straight away. But with the New Zealand employment system, I had to. I think many immigrants would have caught up with things quickly if they were given chances to be trained for jobs. Some immigrants would come to New Zealand with big dreams, but those dreams could not progress without securing a job. I was able to get a full-time cleaning job for night shift while I was studying a 2-year English course at the Waikato Institute of Technology in Hamilton. A good friend of mine at school introduced me to someone who knew a cleaning company, and I applied for a cleaning job. I learned that networking was very important to find a job in New Zealand. As an immigrant, it was even difficult to get a cleaning job. It's hard to get a job without knowing anyone. I started going to work at night while going to school during the day. After completing the English course, my English had improved a lot. I enrolled for a certificate in social practice, and I completed it in 2013. Some employers entertain racial profiling at the workplace, despite it being against the law. At my cleaning job, I was called many racial names. Although they all knew my last name, Butu, which was easy to pronounce for anyone, my colleagues would say things like, "Hey, Blackie, bring this and that." I was upset. The more disturbing thing was that even when I raised the issue of racial discrimination to my supervisor, he never acted. When I approached my manager, he didn't take any action either. In the end, I quit my job because racism affected me mentally at work. My Indian workmate in the same company went through the same racial discrimination, and he also quit his job. With this experience of racial discrimination, I didn't know who to turn to for help, especially after my manager didn't do anything to stop what was going on. I felt like I didn't belong. A word of advice to new immigrants and those who are coming to settle in New Zealand is that it is a completely different environment here. Be prepared for culture shock. You may not find a job as quickly as you wish upon your arrival, or your boss might be lenient with racial discrimination in the workplace. Weather and social life are also different. Life in New Zealand is good. People are friendly. Kids go to school for free and healthcare is awesome. But it's so stressful if you don't have family members who will be on your side for moral support. In New Zealand, you can say anything or do anything you wish as long as you don't cross the line. Freedom of speech or freedom to associate with anyone is pretty much provided to anybody in New Zealand. But some people quickly abuse these freedoms. Many young immigrants quickly forget that it was a lack of such freedoms that forced them out of their respective countries in the first place. I came to New Zealand to rebuild my life. I am currently a second-year student studying for a Bachelor of Social Work in Auckland while working part-time. My dream is to work with people and help them. New Zealand is my home, and I have to contribute to building it.
I think that we do have to be measured. I do think we have to be prepared, put in good resource to ensure that the resettlement is a positive experience both for those people coming here and for the people living in New Zealand already.
I am from Ethiopia. I spent the years of my youth liberating my people in Ethiopia. I joined the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a mass rebellion movement established to overthrow the communist dictator, Colonel Mengistu Haile Mariam. Initially, Haile Mariam came into power in 1978 after overthrowing the emperor, Haile Selassie, in a bloody coup. After the coup, this communist dictator ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist. He used an autocratic military mechanism that he called Derg, and the rest of the world called Red Terror. He committed genocide throughout his tenure in office. He also relied on the Soviet Union for economic plans, which yielded no favorable results. Eventually, Ethiopia was hit by terrible famine. As a result of his dictatorship, Tigray People's Liberation Front and other armed forces of Ethiopia formed an alliance. In May 1991, we were able to overthrow the communist dictator. After removal of the Derg, or Red Terror, regime, all of the armed forces, including Tigray People's Liberation Front, merged and formed a transitional government under the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front in an effort to restore democracy and the rule of law. I was honoured to serve in the transitional government under Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi Aris. I was a big man, holding an influential position in Ethiopia, but I was not happy with the government that I served. This was because there were a lot of abuses of the rights we had fought for as a nation. There was no space to speak up. Although the new Prime Minister had made a lot of economic recovery within a short period of time, he failed to deliver democracy. He used to talk about fighting for democracy and civil rights, but there was only lip service. Eventually, my unhappiness with the new regime was noticed by the intelligence apparatus, and my basic rights were breached. In 1993, I decided to flee Ethiopia. Bearing in mind that the Ethiopian government was looking for me, I asked one of my relatives to accompany me to Eritrea to avoid suspicion along the way. We both dressed up and acted like farmers and set out to the northern region of Ethiopia. We walked for 4 horrible days to reach the nearest town in Eritrea. When we arrived, I went straight to the Dikembe military base, the largest military base in Eritrea, because I didn't know anybody. I was hoping that I could get a temporary permit that would allow me to stay legally in Eritrea. Luckily, I was able to obtain the temporary permit that I needed. I had to spend days without food because I didn't have any money to buy food. I had a gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch that I could sell, but nobody could buy them. This was because the trade law in Eritrea required that I must have a receipt for anything that I wanted to sell. Unfortunately, I had no receipt. People might have thought that I'd stolen them, so nobody wanted to buy my items. In the end, I became a hungry man in the streets of Asmara, the capital city of Eritrea. I also didn't have a place to sleep. I searched for a place to spend a night, but I couldn't find one. So I went to the nearest police station to spend the night in jail. The police officer in the night duty asked me, "What do you want?" "I want to spend a night in jail," I told him. "Why? Have you killed anybody?" the police officer asked. "No, I haven't committed any crime, sir. I'm new in town and I don't know anybody. I'm flat broke. I just want to spend a night here. I'll leave tomorrow morning," I replied. He noticed that I was very weak, so he opened the door for me. "You'll sleep in a woman's cell. There are no female prisoners today," he replied, and directed me to the cell. I consented to the police officer and followed his directions. I slept on the bare, cold floor without a bed or blanket. It was an awful night. No one offered me a place to spend the night except the prison. "This is an interesting world," I said to myself as I fell asleep. In the morning, I woke up and thanked the police officer for his kindness, and then I disappeared into the streets. As soon as I stepped out of the prison, I met a shoe shiner. "I have gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch with me, and I want to sell them cheap. Would you be interested?" I asked. "Oh, good, I want your watch. How much are you selling for? It looks expensive," the shoe shiner replied. 120 Ethiopian birr, but I don't have the receipts." "Never mind about the receipts," the shoe shiner replied, and agreed to buy the flashy citizen watch. "I'll give you 20 birr as a tip," I replied, after receiving the 100 birr from him. My life in Asmara was not good. I didn't feel well, and I even had a suicide plan. Eventually, I decided to look for help. I used the 80 birr out of my 100 birr to make a phone call to one of my relatives in Saudi Arabia, asking for immediate financial help. My relative immediately reacted to my situation and sent me 1,000 birr within a few minutes. I was overexcited. I felt like a millionaire. Happiness was written all over my face. My mission was to get out of Africa. By any means, I wanted to get out of Eritrea because I felt insecure. If Ethiopian authorities had ever found me, I would have been arrested or killed. I had to act quickly. I approached several embassies in Asmara to get a visa out of Eritrea. However, all of the embassies I contacted declined to provide me with a visa. It was only the Italian embassy that was willing to issue me a visa, but they wanted to charge me US$3,000, and there's no way that I could possibly afford it. So my search for a visa failed terribly. I even went to the American consulate to seek help, but the rude American senior employee didn't want to talk to me. He also looked down on me. I asked him, "Can you help me find where to go to be helped as a refugee?" "Okay, this guy will take you to the place that deals with people like you. Just follow him," he replied, and instructed one of his guys on what to do. There I met Peter Cook, the general manager of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I presented my case to him, a political refugee case. He listened to me and said, "I will first check your details in Ethiopia to make sure that you indeed ran away for political reasons." He took my details, including my job title, work address, home phone number and address. He wanted to verify whether I could be granted as a political asylum under United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Eritrea. A few days later, I was called to Peter Cook's office to be briefed about the facts he had found about me in Ethiopia. He said, "I agree with you that you have indeed escaped Ethiopia for political reasons, so I consent to provide you the protection you need." As of the 1st of January 1994, I became the first refugee in Eritrea. I was granted political asylum under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees with available and valid reasons. At that time, Eritrea was the newest nation, and a United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees branch had just been established there. Peter Cook offered me a job, but I turned his offer down because I wasn't interested in working. I just wanted to get out of the vicinity of Ethiopia. It would take no time and energy for Ethiopian intelligence officers to find me in Eritrea. One time, two Ethiopian security operatives even tried to kidnap me in Eritrea's Port Massawa, and I was only able to survive with the help of my cousin. The people at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees knew my life was at risk, so I was told to go to Sudan in a manner that resembled deportation. I had no choice but to accept to go to Khartoum, Sudan, for my own safety. This was after I'd been living in Eritrea for a year and a half. This had been a difficult time, for I was also dealing with the loss of my son, who had died back in Ethiopia. Life in Khartoum was a bit better than Eritrea. I got a job with an Irish non-governmental organisation in Khartoum to support myself. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees told me that my case was preferred for Australia. Several months had passed without hearing from Australia. After a long waiting period, I finally heard from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It's so unfortunate that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Sudan was so corrupted. You have to bribe the key United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees employees to get your file processed, said the officer. In 1997, I was offered a chance to resettle in Canada with three other political asylum colleagues. I satisfied all of their requirements. I met all the costs, including the medical checkup. I paid 600,000 Sudanese dollars, roughly equivalent to US$1,000. I was medically fit and everything was good. This application looked promising in every single way, but for unknown reasons, the case died. By that time, I felt like all of my doors were closed. I had heard that political refugee cases were processed urgently and that political asylum seekers usually got cleared for resettlement within a month by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. However, I spent 6 months staying in Sudan, and while waiting, I lost hope. Then unexpectedly, good luck knocked at my door. An interview with a woman for a chance to resettle in New Zealand. I was blown away with this great news. I didn't expect anything at this point in time. I got ready for the interview. This Kiwi woman who interviewed me was super polite. She felt sorry for me after hearing my story. Political asylum seekers do not have to wait 6 months without being given a chance to resettle. This category is always urgent, said the Kiwi woman. I finished the interview and she told me, "You will be resettling in New Zealand." I was super excited. I spent most of that afternoon reading about New Zealand online because I'd never heard of this tiny, peaceful nation. The resettlement process was also expedited. I came to New Zealand in 2000. I stayed in the Māngere Refugee Resettlement Centre upon arrival. After 6 weeks, it was time to move into the communities. I wanted to live in Auckland, so I talked to Housing New Zealand. However, my request was declined because I was destined for Wellington. Regardless of the decision on the resettlement location, I didn't really like how the employees of Housing New Zealand treated me in processing my case. They were so rude, but I brushed off their rudeness. Luckily, two Kiwi friends took me to their house to stay with them. This was my first taste of kindness in New Zealand. I liked the country already. I stayed with these two friends in their house in Auckland for 2 years. Life in Auckland was crazy. It was a new way of life with terrible weather. It was hard to cope. Culture shock is a big thing that affects all immigrants, and I was no exception. Although I was lucky to be able to speak English, I had to pay extra attention when listening because people here speak very fast. Searching for a job is the main headache for newly arrived immigrants. I was a certified nurse back home, but I was told that my existing knowledge and skills wouldn't matter here, especially if I'd never worked in the field in New Zealand in the last 5 years. My nursing diploma was of no use unless I upgraded it, so I enrolled for a course and found a job in a supermarket. Through my supermarket job, I earned some money. Finally, after years on the run, I was able to support my wife, whom I'd left in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. I started a process of bringing my family to New Zealand through the family sponsorship program. In 2002, my family joined me in Auckland. I was very happy. I talked to Housing New Zealand again and asked them about accommodation. Surprisingly, they acted differently this time. They provided my family with a house and we stayed together as a family once again after 9 painful years apart. I'm currently a self-employed city taxi driver. Taxi driving is good and terrible at the same time. It's good in a way that you're your own boss, but it's terrible in a sense that you can get robbed and the police wouldn't respond to your calls as urgently as possible. Sometimes a passenger wouldn't pay me because of my race, and even when I've reported an incident, no actions have been taken. There's not much protection for people of colour in the taxi business. One time, a drunken passenger vomited in my taxi but refused to clean it when I asked him to. I called the police, but when you don't talk like a Kiwi, they don't respond to your call quickly. There's a lot of racism in the taxi business, but that doesn't override my love for New Zealand. One good thing about New Zealand is that it provides a lot of democratic spaces. You can breathe out your frustration until your lungs are exhausted. In Africa, the police are viewed as an enemy of the communities, but in New Zealand, police are the best friends of the communities. The healthcare system here is superb. Most people are very polite, although you encounter some rude people like in Housing New Zealand. But people help you when you're in dire need. One time, my expectant wife went into labour and called an ambulance. While she was hurrying to the hospital, she gave birth on the motorway. She got all the help she needed along the way. There are no such services in Ethiopia, Eritrea, or Sudan. New Zealand is my home and my kids have a future here, and they know it. I'll take this opportunity to thank Eritrea and Sudan for their hospitality and thank the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees for the care. And for those who want to immigrate to New Zealand, I'll say that this is a great country to live, but you have to come with a clear goal and program. As long as you respect the law, respect other people and know what you're doing, you'll be good. Some people start messing up on arrival because they don't know what they're looking for in life once they get to New Zealand. They expect everything here to be a bed of roses. Francesca Marciano couldn't have put it better when he said, "When you leave Africa, as the plane lifts, you feel that more than leaving a continent, you're leaving a state of mind. Whatever awaits you at the other end of your journey will be of a different order of existence. So be prepared."
Originally, I came to New Zealand from Sudan on the 20th of July, 2012. I had lived in a refugee camp in Chad for 8 years. I went there with my husband and 5 kids, 2 girls and 3 boys. After 6 years in the refugee camp, my husband passed away. After my husband's sudden death, my daughter and I became very ill. The 2 years following my husband's passing proved to be a very difficult time for me. And this is what led us to being referred to New Zealand as an emergency case for treatment. First, the good thing about New Zealand is the way the government treated us regarding our health problems. Secondly, the simple life provides us with hope to feel our happiness and live with our family together. What worries me in terms of challenges contributing to my life in New Zealand is first of all the language problem. I came to New Zealand without knowing any other people, and this provided a real challenge. I speak Arabic, so they bring Iraqi people to translate for me, but the dialect of Iraqi people and my accent do not match. Then there are letters from government agencies. For example, Work and Income New Zealand, WINS. Sometimes letters were sent by WINS requesting me to come to an appointment. But no one was able to read that letter for me and tell me the details. So my appointment would pass and my support would be cut. When I was able to go there, they would not back pay me for the payment period I missed. This made things very difficult, because I am the sole person responsible for payments and I'm not working. I cannot get my head around how the health system works either. For example, my daughter was supposed to have an operation on her teeth, but she missed it because of language difficulties and misunderstandings. Being the only person who speaks my language in New Zealand has affected my life greatly. Sometimes there were things happening at my children's school, but I would be unable to come through for them. If they get bullied at school because they look different and they come home and complain about it, I don't have the ability to go and explain what my children are feeling to the school staff. I can't help them with their schoolwork at home either. Sometimes there is a family conference at the school. Since I will not be able to go there and listen to my children's reports, often my children will report themselves. I don't know what to do about it. Everything is stopping me from progressing. But in general, I'm fine and learning to cope with things. I really don't have enough knowledge to say what should be put in place to help me. In my specific case, it would help to have someone who could translate for me. If there was some kind of transitioning system or schooling for parents to make sure they understand what the system of education looks like, that would be great. There are times when my children translate for me, but I have doubts and my heart tells me that what has been relayed is not the complete picture of what has been said. It makes me feel very upset and powerless. I often think that if only there were some kind of proper transition for people on my level, because I guess you can place me as a high needs person in terms of language and in terms of navigating the system. I've never been to school, but this should not stop me from being part of the society I need to be part of. If there was more help in terms of language, this is the most important thing that would make life better for me. Back home, I was amongst my extended family. Everyone was there during Eid al-Adha or other celebrations. I used to go and create an income to support my family. If you have money, you will be able to put your children in school. So comparatively with New Zealand, there is a difference. I acknowledge the government for giving me a house, for giving me benefit, and for my children going to school. But I remain in isolation. Back home, I stayed with extended family where I could see love and happiness in all the social gatherings. Here in New Zealand, I get things that I didn't have back home. And what I had back home, I cannot find here. I hope that things will get better and I will be able to drive to grocery stores and make bill payments on time. It is the basic stuff that matters, but these things are proving to be real challenges. I only pray that the future will be good for my children. I would like my daughter to get married and stay with us, and that our family will grow, and that my other children can go to school and achieve something good. I am hoping for my kids' future to be filled with beautiful things that I have never had in my life. For my older son, Izzedine, I hope he will finish school and go to university, graduate and find a job, and afterwards to go and get married back home and bring his new wife here. The education for my children is what I value most, so if they could go through university, get qualifications and find meaningful jobs, I won't have any other problems. I need to make sure that my grandchildren come from united families. Most importantly, they need to contribute to New Zealand as a country, because this is the country that offers a fair shot in life. I value New Zealand's contribution to my family, and in return, future generations need to contribute back to New Zealand society. I love New Zealand more than any other country. One of the best things I love about New Zealand is freedom of speech. Here you can talk without fear of punishment. Everyone has security guarantees. People are protected by law, irrespective of religion, gender, or age. Sometimes I remember bad things that happened in my life, and those are the times when I get scared. But I know I am safe here.
Welcome back. If you have just joined us, you are listening to Resident Radio, Voice of the Community, and we have been telling stories from Resident Manjane. One of the stories that have been told already, a part of why refugees left their countries and seek refuge in other countries, and when they come to New Zealand, they become part of New Zealand society. They are Kiwis, and they are working hard to build this nation together with the society. So they become part of our society, and no way to look back. You look back in order to move forward. That's what is happening with the resettlement journey, and we proudly say we are new Kiwis, and contrary to the negativity that we are still refugees when we are building nation as our home, because a refugee is someone who has no home, but this is the home we are only have. And with that, I am playing you music from Senegal, Ali Farki, and we will go back to the stories after that. Stay tuned on Gawe. Thank you for listening.
Ubi ma flena luma yeni New Zealand has responded to our call to do that. It's refugee hosting countries in the region, and that's on top of its normal quota. So that's a great start. If New Zealand wanted to increase that, of course, we'd be very pleased.
I am from Myanmar. Myanmar is located in Southeast Asia, formerly known as Burma. Myanmar is bordered by India, Bangladesh, China, Laos, and Thailand. Yangon is the nation's capital. The Myanmar education system is dominated by the Burmese language. English is learned only as a subject in the schools. After completing high school, I obtained a Bachelor of Social Science degree through distance learning, but I couldn't communicate in English. My social science degree led me to my first job, a clerk in Myint Chai Nai Court. The salary of a clerk was a mismatch for Myanmar's markets, far below US $50 per month. Because I couldn't live within my means as a clerk's job, I resigned. I got a managerial job in 1999. I was employed as a sector manager in Upcountry's construction company, based in Yangon. The managerial job didn't take away the financial burden that I had, but it outweighed the earnings from my previous job. The culture of the governing system in Myanmar criminalized fleeing the country as refugees. Relatives of the person who had fled are always subjected to punishment, especially if you just happen to be a government employee. My brother's refugee status in Malaysia affected us, as his relatives still live in Myanmar. There were times I would be called by authorities to record statements, giving them the assurances that I will not run away like my brother. They didn't stop there. They also monitored my movements, even scrutinized my trips between Yangon and the villages. There are no moral grounds for one to be punished because of a relative's wrongdoing. While in Malaysia, my brother was sponsored by the United Nations to move to New Zealand permanently. When my brother informed me that he could sponsor my wife and me to come and live with him in New Zealand, I was excited. I felt that a second chance had come to live a life free of dictatorship. Since my brother lived alone in New Zealand, he was allowed to sponsor a close relative under the Refugee Family Support category. This is allowed in order to avoid stress caused by loneliness. In 2011, my wife and I came to New Zealand under my brother's Refugee Family Support category sponsorship. We didn't go to Mangaree Refugee Resettlement Centre for accommodation because we were not refugees. A dream of a second chance to live a decent life and of making my own decisions without anybody's interference had materialized. Auckland is good, but not the best for a new arrival who doesn't speak English. The struggle to get a job was traumatizing to me. Employers turned me down because of a breakdown in communication. All Work and Income New Zealand wanted to know is why I didn't have a job, but they were not concerned with the reasons behind not having a job. Sometimes Work and Income New Zealand doesn't consider how one's lack of English language is a blockade to employment. After enrolling to study basic English and further four foundations in 2012, my English improved and I got a job as a machine operator at New Zealand Health Manufacturing, a company that produces capsule medicines. Things began to pick up. When I completed a certificate in social services and a diploma in English language, the language barriers that blocked my way to employment disappeared. I managed to find job after job because my English could be understood and I was now capable of understanding employers. I learned several new techniques for job searching. I am currently a full-time student working towards a Bachelor of Social Work degree in Auckland. It is utterly sad when one comes to this great nation and they face discrimination instantly. The truth is that there is a lot of unfair treatment of people of colour in Work and Income New Zealand, as well as StudyLink and Housing New Zealand. Discrimination in such branches is done openly and with no